without further ado, come on. Bye.
God, this is a fancy podium. It's even got a light up here. Hi, I'm Tanya. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tanya.
And by the grace of God, my sobriety date is 07-06-05, which is easy to remember, so I hope I never have to change it. My home group is actually sobriety first in Olathe, Kansas. I come up here often on Big Book studies and shoot in here every once in a while, but never on a fully regular basis because it's just easier to go to my group in Olathe. But I'm up here quite a bit, and I've always enjoyed all the meetings up here. When I was, probably 12, 13, I probably had my first drink. I think it was at the skating rink, and I think it was Purple Passion. and it's like, ooh, it tastes like juice, and then woo, and the euphoria hit. And I think I've pretty much chased that euphoric feeling the rest of my life. And alcohol was always the thing that made me feel complete. There's a lot of other outside issues that I tried to add in with the mix, but alcohol has always been the one steady friend, is what I used to call it back then. I got married twice to the same man, and to me that is insanity that he would marry an alcoholic twice. But we had two sets of kids. We have two older kids and two younger kids because of we broke up, divorced and got remarried. And so people always say, are they from different marriages? And same man, but my older daughter was more affected, I think, from my alcoholism. My son was actually my stepson, so I always say, thank God you have a different mother. And he says, I agree. him and I have a wonderful relationship. He just doesn't have that alcoholic gene in him, and I thank God for that. But my oldest daughter, she's battled a lot of the same stuff I have. But my two little girls are now 9 and 7, and I was telling Mary and Elizabeth that I met. I wish I would have brought them up because they would have had a ball playing with them. But they have never, thank God, had to see me drunk. They were too little when I found, when sobriety found me, I guess I should say. So I'm grateful for that. And my husband's a normal drinker. He's one of those that can go and drink a half a glass and leave the rest. And I never really, put my finger on that until I got in AA, that we would go out to eat, on the plaza or something. And when we would go to dinner and everyone would have drinks, and wait for their table and then be seated, and we'd order another round of drinks. And when the food would come, everyone would push their drink away and be like, yeah, the food's here. And I'm like, can I get another round, and a to-go box? Because I had a buzz going on and I didn't want to eat food now. And I always thought that was really strange. And then, they were paying for the tab, and I'd be like, well, go on to the car. I'm waiting on my to-go box. And they would head on to the car, and I'd suck down everyone and all the drinks around the table, because I didn't want them to go to waste. And then we'd get in the car and with my to-go box of food. And on the way home, I'd be like, turn right up here. There's a liquor store right up here on your right. And my husband would be like, why? I'm like, well, come on, turn. It's like 10 till midnight. And he's like, we got beer at home. I'm like, I am not going to drive all the way home. That's like a 20-minute drive, stop. And he would stop because he didn't want to hear me whining all the way home about not having an open container in the vehicle. Because I had set the allergy in motion, and there was just no turning back. And I didn't understand any of that. I did not know why I was different. And I actually had I actually turned it into a pride thing, I could drink anyone under the table, and isn't that funny how we turn those things into such a pride issue, and it was like, I look back on that and I think, I must have looked like such an idiot to so many people, and I'm sure I did. And but it always came first. It always came first in my life. I remember going boating in the summertime, you know, when my older kids were young, and they would go up to the cooler to get a drink, and there would be nothing but beer in there, you know, and they would say, Mom, did you pack anything for us? And you know, no, I didn't, and I didn't think it was weird that I didn't, you know. I thought, well, I mean, it's so selfish, the complete selfishness, that I just worried about myself, and, you know, well, why didn't my husband pack something for them, you know? Well, it's not my responsibility. And, oh, my gosh, I look back on that stuff, and I just think how sick that is. And there's a million other stories. That's just a very vague story. But, you know, we can go to such depths at the self-centeredness and selfishness. And you know, I look back on how sick I made my entire family. And little did I know that I had been building a silo, one brick at a time, up around my entire family, and decorated it with Pottery Barn, you know, like we weren't in a pit. And, you know, everyone out there knows you're in a pit, but no one in your home knows you're in a pit, because it's a family illness. And that's when that finally came to light, it made everything so clear. But my little sister had a church just around the corner. She was going to church and kept inviting me to this Alpha program that they were having. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. Not unless they serve alcohol. And it was Tuesday nights at 6 o'clock. And I'm like, especially no, you know, by 6 o'clock in the evening, I'm not going to any church anywhere. And so she had them praying for me. A little did I know. I mean, I had no clue. And but she had them praying for me because I was an alcoholic. And the only time I would stay sober was during my pregnancies. And so, and I had worked at Ford for 10 years in the warehouse. And that was just, you know, working in that atmosphere, it was just a give that you drank. I mean, everyone would wait till I worked the night shift. So 6 o'clock in the morning, man, we would hit the parking lot, and I would have beer and a cooler already, and we'd drive around town sucking down beers, and then I'd go back to the warehouse and get on the forklift and woo, you know. And it was normal because everyone did it. Even the supervisors would come up to you and say, you need some gum, you know, you need some gum. And it was just, it was not abnormal to do that. It was just, they even had a sign in the parking lot that said, no alcohol on the premises. You know, it was like, that's pretty bad when a company has to put the sign up. And so this, you know, it, like the book says, it had become normal. This way of living had become normal to me and to my family, too. They didn't think anything of it. I had them all so used to it. Well, I got pregnant and decided to stay home and have another baby, and I had another baby. And that was the only time I was able to stay sober, and I was absolutely miserable the entire time I was pregnant. And misery is just a gift that keeps on giving. And so everyone around me was miserable, too. And, of course, I could blame it on the pregnancy and blame it on being uncomfortable. And you know, really, bottom line, I was restless, irritable, and discontent because I couldn't numb myself from life and from feelings. And anyway, so this is when she had them praying for me after the birth of my last baby and hoping that I wouldn't pick the drink up again. You know, of course, I always did. Picked up the first thing I did. In fact, the first thing I did when I was in the hospital, when they came in and said, are you nursing? And I said, yes, a beer. You know, give me a bottle for the baby and a bottle for me. And I would, you know, my husband would bring beer in for me because I deserved it, you know. And we would ice it down in the sink in the little mother's room or whatever, you know. And I'm not kidding, you know, I would crack me a beer. I deserve it, you know. And, you know, I deserved everything I got. It was never enough. Nothing's ever enough. I always find, you know, that if anyone ever talked to me about my drinking, oh, my gosh, you know, I would just start listing 10 things off that I didn't like about you and what you could do to change to make me happy, you know. And it was always all about me. And I drank because you irritated me, you know. I drank because I had to clean the house. I drank because, you know, I'd always have all these excuses of why I drank and why I needed to drink because, you know, you people annoyed me. And I always try to put them on a guilt trip about that. So You know, just looking back on how sick the whole alcoholism trip is. And so, anyway, so after I get home, of course, the first thing I do, which I'd already started in the hospital, but now I'm home, so I can smoke, too. Smoke and drink and trying to take care of these new babies, you know, and I couldn't keep up with things. And the alcohol, at least for me, and I've heard this from many alcoholics, people out there call it a depressant, and not for me, it was actually speed. Most people have a few drinks and they want to go to bed, and I think the majority of alcoholics have a few drinks, they want to go to town, and I mean, that's when I would get my lift and I would clean the house or I would go do, you know, but during this period of time, I was getting, it wasn't working that way. And so this is where my outside issue comes in, but there's a good reason to bring it up. I sought out what I thought was cocaine. And here, I think I was 36 at the time, and it's like, you know, how many 36-year-olds with two new babies at home and two grown children seek out cocaine? And, I mean, you know, how abnormal is that? Well, I bought what I thought was cocaine, brought it home, and it looked all funny, and I said, I called up the drug dealer. I'm like, what is this? You know, what do I do with this? She's like, you just crush it. You know, you just crush it up into a powder as fine as dust. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, they sure have changed the cocaine since I used it last. So I crush it into a powder as fine as dust. Well, it wasn't until months later that I found out what I was really using, that it was meth and it wasn't coke. Not that that really matters, but I always heard that that was way worse than cocaine for some reason. And but it didn't stop me. I was way beyond that line. I was already had another new solution on top of the alcohol and to give me that enhancement. So now my little sister's really floored because she's thinking, okay, we were praying for her because she's an alcoholic and now she's a drug addict. You know, this is not working. I mean, these prayers aren't working. You know, what is this faith stuff? So anyway, when I finally got busted and put in a corner by my whole family, you know, I said, I need to go to treatment. And I knew nothing about treatment. I thought they were going to strap me down in a straitjacket or something. I had no clue. Didn't even know there was such thing as treatment centers. And so, but I had agreed to go. And my husband was going to go on this fishing trip that was planned, like, up in Canada. And I was like, you know, go. You need to go to your fishing trip, though. You know, I'll go next week. You know how we always try to buy more time. And I'm like, but you gotta leave me some money, you know, because I would like to sell the TV or something. And I convinced him that I couldn't function without doing this stuff. And that's just how sick we can make our family members. And so he did. He left me money and he went on his fishing trip. My little sister found out. And she, I took off to, and she came over and got my kids. And took them back with her. And I'm thinking, well, good. At the time, I'm thinking my kids are safe. My husband's out of town. Party, you know. I'm like, I'm straight to the liquor store, straight to the drug house with my money that he left me, and with no regrets, no remorseful feelings or anything. And I get a phone call, and I was supposed to receive one phone call before he got on the final plane into his destination where he wouldn't have phone service. And so I'm thinking this is the phone call, and then I'm home free, you know, without him for a week. And it was a phone call saying, I guess my little sister called him and said, you need to get home now, or I'm going to call the police on you for child endangerment, for leaving your wife with your children, knowing the state of mind she's in. And, he got on a plane in Minneapolis and flew home. And when I found that out, I was just livid. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. I get a phone call from my husband saying, you need to come home. I'm home. I just dropped the phone. I'm like, what? And I didn't come home for 3 days. I turned that phone off, and I did not come home for 3 days. And so I guess they had now the news and stuff was missing. And, of course, after the drugs ran out and the beer ran out and the Smirnoff ran out, and it was the 4th of July, and I'm like, okay. I called home and I said, you know, I want to come home and I want to watch fireworks with my kids, but I don't want, you know, I don't want to catch a hard time. I don't want this. I don't want that. I started making my list and they were like, okay. And I hung that phone up with the intention of going home, and then going to treatment the next day, and I hadn't slept in like 3 days, so I fell asleep in the apartment that I was in, which had dynamite in the closet. It was a really weird place. And the guy that lived there didn't even, he wasn't even like in the home. He was in jail, so I don't know who was let us in, but anyway, it was just, you know, the crazy insanity. And so I fell asleep, and I woke up at 2 in the morning. I'd missed 4th of July with my kids. Like, I hadn't missed the last couple of years with them, you know. But I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is nuts. This has got to stop. And so as much fear as I was filled with, thinking, how am I going to go into treatment, and they're going to take everything away from me that I know, that I know how to function on. How am I going to function? But that fear of just, and that feeling of missing all that with my kids at that moment over, thank God, you know, it took over and was more important than the fear for that moment. And so I finally get home and I get taken to treatment. And I had to go to Two Rivers first because I had drug-induced schizophrenia. I was hearing things. I was seeing things. Going up in my attic and taking pictures of electricity that ran down the walls and stuff, trying to find the cameras that I just knew were in my home, you know. Everyone, you know, usually on drugs looks out the window for the people in the trees, you know. No, mine was in the house. I knew they were. I knew someone was watching me, you know. And so it was just crazy, this crazy insanity that was going on in my head. And so, but I ended up going into Two Rivers and being medicated for the paranoia and stuff like that, which I don't even remember the stay there. I guess I was there a week, and I never got out of bed. And the doctor finally came back to see me in that room, was like, why do you not get out of bed? And I'm like, because I'm a meth addict. Don't you have any of those here? I didn't know, you know. And it was just nuts. It was nuts. And I thought, okay, well, then I found out I'd been clean and sober for a week. So I was like, all right, you know, even though I slept through it, I mean, still that counts, right? And so, and then I thought I was going to get to go home, and then we didn't start heading home, and I'm like, where are we going? And we're going to Valley Hope. You are not done. And I'm like, I just want to go home, you know? And God only knew that I for the longest time afterwards, I found paraphernalia all through my house, you know? So who knows what my addict brain was saying. Go home, there's a line in the bathroom, and under the sink, you know? I had all these hidden... I had built hidden shelves and stuff up underneath my bathroom sinks and just the craziness of it all. Yes. Yeah. And I was like, I qualify as an alcoholic, I'll say, because I went to Radio Shack and bought those little beepers that you put on keys so that when you lose one, you can beep number 6. And I put those around the neck of my beers, you know, like, so I got to beep my beer because I couldn't find it. It was sick. I was like, this was normal. All this was normal to me, you know. I looked back and I was like, that was not normal. So I go into Valley Hope and I'm going, okay, what is this place now? Now it's a straitjacket, I'm sure, you know, because I'm really nuts. And they take me on a tour around the building And I just remember them, some doors swinging open. I'm like, what is that? I'm thinking, is that a church inside a building? I'd never been exposed to that as a child. And, you know, we just didn't do that thing, you know, when I was growing up. And so when I saw little pews and stuff, and I was like, is that a church inside of a building? Do people die here or what? You know? That's the only thing I could relate it to, was a funeral or something, you know? I didn't get married in the church, and so it was like, no, you know? And I said, well, that's optional. And I'm like, well, thank God, because I'm not going in there, you know? Can't make me. And so, I get set up with my counselors and everything. And you know, they start taking us to AA and taking us to NA, and you know, and I'm like, really, I didn't miss the drugs I wanted. That was what I was going to say about my sister's prayers, because I wanted off of the drugs. I wanted back to normal, just drinking. I just wanted off of the drugs, you know. I just didn't like those. They were too hard to keep up with, you know. But don't take my drinking away. On the way to treatment, my husband even said, you know, maybe you ought to try to quit drinking while you're in here. And if the car hadn't been going 65, I would have got out. I would have got out. I said, you are not taking my only enjoyment away from me. And my little sister, when she heard that, she said, doesn't she realize, you know, that her kids, you know, are her enjoyment? And and life is her enjoyment, and no, that was my enjoyment. Drinking was my enjoyment. I've done it all my adult life, and so that's why I think my little sister can look back and say, man, I thought those prayers weren't being answered because we were praying that she wasn't an alcoholic. And she turned into a drug addict. But it was just like God knew that that would get my butt in there. And it did. And I still thought, I'm not going to quit drinking in here. I'm just going to quit doing the drugs. And so I get in there and I see that little chapel in there. And I'm like, you cannot make me go in there. And so I was out in the little smoking pit out there, Valley Hope, and this little girl comes running out with the little tin cross, and she's like, I got my cross. I'm like, what'd you get a cross for? And she's like, we're going to chapel 10 times. So I'm like, well, what a cross? Thinking, I didn't care what it stood for. You weren't any better than me. I didn't get my cross, And so I thought, okay, I started going to chapel, and just to get my cross, though. In fact, I even lied about that. On my ninth time, I was like, raise my hand, because the buddy that I'd met, I buddied up with had raised his hand too, and so I'm like, I'm going to get mine, that's enough. And so I raised my hand, and so I get my little tin cross, and I'm all proud of myself, and as I'm leaving that chapel with that little tin cross, all of a sudden I just had a pang in my stomach, and I said, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And I'm thinking, where did that come from? With my history, where did that come from? It probably cost a nickel. Where did that come from? And it would not leave me. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to go in the morning, and I'll just make it even. No one even knew. They probably didn't even care, just to get you in there, And so I'm like, okay. So I get up in the morning, and I go to chapel. I'm like, it's all done. I've done my 10. Well, that was the first day that I remember taking anything in that was ever said there. And it happened to be Psalm 23. And they read Psalm 23, and it said, the Lord is my shepherd. And I said, really? My last name used to be Lamb. And I'm like, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And then when it said, he maketh me lie down in green pastures, I'm like, well, I need to lie down somewhere. I've been awake for 2 years, man. He just speaks your own language. The part where it says, he restores my soul. And I was on step 2. And I'm thinking, he restores my soul. And, restores my sanity. And so it was just, things started connecting, Things started meaning a little bit more than they were on the surface. And I'm like, that's weird. And so I go to my room after I felt good, everything was even. And I didn't feel guilty anymore. And I went to my room to get my notebook for lecture. And I was in room 23. Were you really? Oh my gosh, that's so crazy. And I'm like, room 23, that's really weird. And so I go down to lecture that day, and I'm just kind of feeling a little bit differently, a little bit better, things were brighter, the sun was shinier, the leaves were crisper. I don't know, there's just something going on inside that I couldn't put a finger on. And so I hear this lecture. Biker Larry did this lecture, and he did like statistics on the board, and I may even be wrong, but this is what I remember of that lecture, that the bottom line, he says, if you do this, here's basically the statistics of your percentage of, and they're never exact, but they give you their best shot at what your percentage is if you do these things, and stuff to their best ability. He said, 3 out of 10 of you will make it. 7 of you won't. Don't miss a lecture while you're here. It may be the one lecture that keeps you sober way down the road. And I'm like, what? 7 of us aren't going to make it? So only 3 of us are going to make it? And I was floored by that. I thought this was a 100% deal. I had no clue. I thought this was going to fix me up. I was going to go home, everything fine. And I went back to my room after that lecture, and my stomach hurt because I had eaten 3 meals a day, and I was not used to 3 meals a day, and I was having a reaction to some medicine, and I remember wanting to lay on my stomach because it hurt so bad. And I lay on that floor, and I just started sobbing with that lecture in my brain that I may not make it. And I was just the most hopeless I'd ever felt. And I said, oh, God, please let me be one of those 3 if I have to shoot the other 7. And that was my third step. that prayer. And he heard it. So far, so good. Thank God. And so, you know, faith as small as a mustard seed, all it needs. And so that was my third step prayer. It doesn't have to be perfect. That's a good thing. And so, anyway, so that was my third step prayer. So then I finally figured out that I'm supposed to be in this small group thing that they're doing, and that I had a chaplain named Larry. I thought that Larry was the only Larry I was supposed to go to, and I was all confused. And so anyway, I go to this small group, and I hadn't shared anything in any of the small groups that, you know, because I thought it was really strange that I was, you know, these people were too weird and that I wasn't going to tell them anything about me. And so this woman told a story about her mother. She said when she was 11 years old, she would, they lived in a small town, and her sister would be at the bar every night, because her mom would be inside drinking at the bar, and they would play in the parking lot until her mom was ready to go home. And when her mom was ready, or the bar would close or whatever, and they would have to round her mom up. And anyway, the little girl, the younger one, would push on the gas pedal, and the older one would steer and drive her mom home every night from the bar. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, what a horrible mom. You know, I'm judging this mom from a little town, and I'm thinking, that is awful. And then I just started bawling, and Larry looks at me, and he's like, Tammy, you want to share something? I said, I did the same thing. I said, my daughter was 12, and she wanted to go downtown Kansas City and pick up a friend that had moved back in with her father. And I'm like, all right, you know, so we get in the van and head to downtown Kansas City. And she'd never driven on the roads. She'd never driven on the highways or anything. She was 12. And I was strung out, and I was been drinking, and I'm swerving all over the road, you know. And I had to pull over, and she insisted that I pull over, and she finished the drive there and back in rush hour traffic with two babies in the car seat. And I'm judging that mom. And it was just like God put a mirror in that room for me to see myself, you know, my reflection. And that was a rude awakening, to say the least. And I started hearing things that I normally couldn't hear. I started seeing things that I normally couldn't see. And so I started seeing, you know, I finally figured out that Chaplain Larry was the chaplain I was supposed to be seeing, and I didn't even know what a chaplain was, but this man that I was supposed to, you know, and I was finally on my fourth step, and it was about the time I was supposed to be, well, wait a minute, let me back up to that small group experience one more time. My daughter at home, I guess she was probably about 16 at the time, she found a bunch of meth bags in a picture box at home, and she brought them up there to Valley Hope. And in the small groups, you know, sometimes you'd have to write a letter to your dead father or whatever, you know, whatever it was you weren't letting go. And they would have different little ceremonies that you'd have to do. And we'd burn them on the grill, we'd do this, we'd do that. And well, with these meth bags, you know, that they were given to the counselor, and they said, well, we can't, like, burn them on the grill. They might cut off the trigger for somebody, you know, and can't flush them down the toilet, they might come back up. So they're like, what do we do with them? Oh, I know, we'll take them to the river. Well, we had a small field trip, you know, we took them to the river, and I tied them in an envelope to a rock, and I had to stand on the pier with this rock in my hand and say what this addiction had done to me and my family. And that was very hard. And I remember crying, and I looked down at the board, and there was a little something sticking out of the board, and I just remember staring at it. And then I threw that rock in. And then that was the end of that thing, thank God. And so when I was getting ready to get out of there, and I wasn't all the way done with my fourth step, I didn't really like doing my fourth step. I didn't know the freedom that was going to come from that fourth step. And so, but Chaplain Larry said, you know, you really need to come back up here and do your fourth step, do your fifth step. Go home, finish that fourth step, and be fearlessly and thoroughly finish that thing and bring it back up here and give it to me. And I thought, writing something down is going to keep me sober? I mean, I just could not wrap my brain around that. So I went home, and I remember that lecture that Larry had been doing, you know, the percentages, and I'm like, oh, crap, you know, I better do, what percentage does that take off if I don't finish it, you know, so I thought I better just get back up there and do it. And so just because I was following directions, it was suggested that I follow directions. And so I got back up there and gave Chuck O'Leary that fifth step. And when I was done, he's like, how do you feel? And I'm like an idiot. I didn't feel anything. I had no wind blowing on the mountaintop, like Bill says, you know. And so I'm thinking, you know, well, that was just a waste of time. And I thought, well, at least I did what I was supposed to do. So I'm driving home from Valley Hope, and I was digging in my van to get some change because they don't have caffeine there, so I'm going to stop and get me one on the way home. I'm looking for some change, and I pull out a vial that I used to keep one hit in, and I'm like, oh, crap. And I opened that sucker up, and all it had was dust in it. And I put that lid, thank God, I put that lid back on it, and I'm driving past the river. And I turned really fast, and I went down there to that little pier, and I looked down at that board that I'd been standing on, and I stood on that same little board, and I said a prayer, and I talked to him for the first time by myself. And I threw that thing in. And I happened to be looking down, and I started crying again. And I looked down, and I counted that board I was on. It was board 23. I said, so I go on home after that. And there were a lot of stuff happened in my first year. A lot of ups, a lot of downs. The family afterwards, you know, that you get home after you realize you're in a pit and you come in treatment or AA or what, you realize you get out of that pit and you go home and your family's still in the pit and they don't know that they're still in the pit. It makes it really hard, you know. Thank God for Al-Anon, and for Lois, you know. And so about a year later though, I'm listening to, I wanted to get to know the God of my understanding, you know, and I'm listening to different sermons and stuff like this, you know, because they all related to my alcoholism. And it was old Vernon McGee, this really old man, so he's dead now, but anyway, he does this thing called the Bible Bus, and he goes through the whole thing, and I was listening to him cleaning my garage out. He was in Deuteronomy, and he reads out of Deuteronomy 9:21, where Moses is coming down the hill, the mountain, and he sees him worshiping the calf. And he says, I took that sinful thing of yours, and I burned it in the fire, and I crushed it into a powder as fine as dust, and threw it in the stream that went down the valley. It came out of the valley. I'm like, what? What? I ran in and grabbed the Bible and looked that up, and I'm like, oh, my God, that is what we did. That's all that was in those bags was dust. That's all that was in that vial was dust. And I threw it in the river. It came down the hill from Valley Hope. And I'm like, oh, it just blew me away. It was just like God was standing in my garage at that moment saying that fifth step did matter. It did matter. Just because you didn't feel anything, any wind blowing on the mountaintop or anything, it did matter. And it'd been a year, and it was like him saying, don't forget where we came from. Thank God, I never forgot where we came from. And it's been almost 5 years. And how much time do I got here? What time did I start? 8:30. Got 15 minutes. Okay, I just wanted to. So that was basically, you know, then I got out of there. And you know, just so much stuff has happened in the last 5 years. There's just been a lot of ups and a lot of downs. But later on, after I did that fifth step, you know, then I'm thinking, okay, now I gotta do, you know, step 6 and 7. I thought, why are they stuck in the middle there? That just didn't even make sense to me at the time. I'm thinking, why are they stuck in the middle? You know, and I get a sponsor, and she's like, just do, you know, you do your steps. And so, I'm after, you know, doing, you know, step 6, where you're becoming ready to have him, I thought, I'm fine, everything's great now. You know, I just thought after the fifth step, I could have just been done with it, you know. And oh my gosh, you know, I wasn't fine, and everything wasn't all right. But I felt so high on life at the time that I thought, I don't need really to do anymore. Well, yeah, I did. And so after I asked him to take away the rest of my shortcomings and stuff, and I thought, okay, didn't really feel anything there either. But when I had made that fourth step list, and I'm writing down, you know, the people that, you know, everything that I, you know, could think of, and I'm writing, and as I was putting people on that list, though, I was like, well, she deserved that, but I'll put her down, you know. And I'm like, he deserved that too, but I'll put him down too. You know, and I'm putting down, and I'm admitting it in my step 5, you know, what I did to this person, what I did to that person. But in my mind, I'm still thinking that they deserved it. They deserved it, you know. And I'm thinking I'm justifying every one of them that I had down. I had them down, but I was still justifying it and still had my reasons that, you know, I was justified in doing these things. Pretty much all of them, you know. But then, you know, step 6 and 7, you know, that didn't feel like they really did anything. When I went back and I started doing step 8 and to be getting prepared for my step 9 to go in and making these amends, when I was making that list of step 8 to those people that I had harmed and stuff, all of a sudden that same person that, well, when I put them down the first time, like thinking that they deserved it, I started making that list with a new set of eyes. And I'm thinking, you know what? Maybe she wouldn't have burnt my house down had I not slept with her husband. You know, or whatever it was, you know, I'm just making that up. But I'm thinking, all of a sudden, I had like, it was like he gave me a new set of glasses, like Chuck C's book, you know, a new pair of glasses. And I was like, all of a sudden, I was able to take one more step back from this action and see where I had set the ball rolling and see where I, my part in it. And I could leave their part with them. And all of a sudden, I could see my part in it. And all of a sudden, it was like I realized I did in step 6 and 7, and then it just dawned on me, I'm like, that's what happened in 6 and 7. But I didn't know that's what happened in 6 and 7 until I started doing my step 8. Just like they always say, these are a set of steps that we take that we don't believe in until after we take them. And I'm like, that is so true. Because when I looked back on it, then I could see where I was able to put these people down, and I was able to go start making these amends with the right heart and the right motive, and with just cleaning my side of the street, not expecting a thing out of them. And I'm like, this program is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And all of a sudden, I started seeing people in a completely different light. I started seeing the people that, you know, and then I hear people say all the time, let me go there, okay. I'll hear people say, well, I can't forgive myself. You know, I just can't forgive myself. I can't forgive my, and I realized, how did I forgive myself? I mean, I had to think about that, and I'm like, well, duh. When I did step 5 and gave that confession over to God and another human being, I realized that that's when that feeling left me, that I knew I was forgiven. I knew I was forgiven. And then in step 6 and 7, when I got a new heart and a new set of eyes, I was able to go to step 8 and make that list with a new heart, knowing I was forgiven and it was easy to forgive and then make the amends. When I went to make the amends, I didn't have to hold back on that part where I wanted to say, but you did, but if you wouldn't have, you know, I didn't have to feel that feeling of resisting that temptation to say that, because I was truly it came naturally to forgive their part in it and not have to even worry about their part in it. It was just a weird, I don't know how it works, but it's just amazing how it works, really. And I could honestly go make those amends with a forgiving heart in their part in it, whatever it was. It's just a miracle, actually. And then, you know, step 10, 11, and 12, you know, they say to go work it. And step 10, I tell people, you know, that pink cloud, they always say, well, that pink cloud's going to go away. No, it does not have to go away. It can grow bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, you just got to do that step 10. Do that spot check. You know, spot check, spot check. Throw another splash of pink up there so I can ride it another day. You know, and that's how I look at step 10. You know, it's a spot check. If there's something not right and that cloud's kind of gray, it's like, okay, you know, do the spot check and clean whatever it is up. It's right there in front of me. Don't let it go and pile up and pile up. And that's when that pink cloud will just, where'd it go? And so if I stay on top of that step 10, that pink cloud stays there. And step 11 comes naturally because it just comes naturally, you know, to want to have a closer relationship to the God of my understanding. Because I realize it's all about Him. It's all about Him today in this smaller, I can get my ego and my self-centeredness. And I remember driving around in my van one day, and all these things had lined up. And this was still when I was sort of thinking, are these coincidences, you know, early on, you know, when you're still saying that. And all of a sudden, so much stuff happened in one day. The readings from AA, this other thing over here, what I was listening to in the van, this other, all these things, and I just had to pull my van over, and I just started bawling. And I was just like, oh my gosh, who is doing this? No one knows anyone from over there. No one from over there knows anyone here. No one knows I'm listening to this. And it was like, all of a sudden it was like, you know, hello, McFly, you know, it's like, and I mean, he had to be that bold with me, you know, because, and then I look back on that and I think, that is the epitome of self-centeredness. I didn't even have one friend left. And then I think people are going out of their way to line this up for me, you know? I mean, really, how extremely self-centered can a person be that the world just revolves around Tammy, you know? No, it does not. And even if I had one friend left, she wouldn't have been able to keep up with trying to line anything up, you know? So it was just so funny when I look back on it, it's like, okay, you know, duh. And so, you know, and then I always like to say, you know, step 12 is just like the woman at the well, you know, like, he knows everything I did. This man knows everything I did. Well, people know everything I did, and they don't look down on me for it. It's just turned all my weaknesses into my strengths. And it was a while back when I was at all these meetings in a row seemed to revolve around Walmart for some reason, you know. People were always talking about what happened at Walmart, you know, and someone prayed for patients, and they were in line at Walmart in the longest line, you know, because obviously they needed patients, and it was so funny. And so the last time I told the story, I said, you know, step 12 is like the woman at the well, and I'm, and you know, I will be in line at Walmart, and if I'm in line too long, somebody is going to hear my story in some way, shape, or form, you know, and talk about getting that checker to check those things just a little bit faster. You start telling your story in line, and it will move right along. But in the process, while everyone else is moving right along, you got that one person. That one person is going to stop and say, can I have your number? Because my friend has a drinking problem. and you know, that's just, that's the miracle of this program, is that, you know, you can't keep it inside. It really takes no effort for me to talk about my alcoholism and all, you know, all this coming to a spiritual awakening, because it just comes out. And we are the light. And I like Sandy Beach's talk when he says, you know, the ego is that little cloud that keeps the sun from shining on you. And if we can just remove that cloud, the light can shine on us and shine through us. And we can become, the more transparent we can become, you know, the more people are drawn to us. And I just had a wonderful weekend in San Antonio, and I'll wrap that up. I'll wrap it up with that. I was at a convention early on in Kansas City when I was very first in AA, and so it's kind of vague. Everything was happening so fast back then. But I went to that convention down there in San Antonio. And I guess there was like 66,000 people or something there. It was just, and we all had green ribbons on with our name tag. People from all over the world, like 89 countries, those flags came out. And people held their hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And if you could see, you could hear 66,000 people saying the Lord's Prayer. It was just more than I could even handle. It was amazing. And I taught my little girl the Lord's Prayer, because I didn't know it when I got in Valley Hope. I thought it was a conspiracy. I looked around like, "Was everyone? What were they reading off of? Did I miss a class or something? I didn't. How did?" And I later asked them, "How did you know that prayer?" And they said, "I've known that since I was little." You don't know the Lord's Prayer? No. And I had a resentment to my parents, thinking, "How dare you not ever take me to church or anything?" You know, when I was little. But then I realized how fortunate I was when I got into AA, and I've heard struggles from people that have had, you know, resentments with certain things and, you know, that they've been raised with. And I thought, wow, God turns everything into a blessing. What I thought was a resentment, he's like, child, you're better off because you're getting fresh like a child. And I was. He was like a child in my faith, and I just love that about him. And I sure taught my little girl's Lord's Prayer the minute I got home, because I never wanted them to feel like that. And one night my little girl says, "Our Father, who draws in heaven." And I said, "It's your heart in heaven." And she goes, "Drawing his heart, Mommy. You're the one that says he draws the clouds in the sky." Okay. And my other little girl said, "Amen." My husband's like, "How many men?" I'm like, "Shut up. Amen is fine. Amen is fine, you know." And so it's just priceless. It's priceless, a gift that you can give, you know, your children, and see them, you know, grow up. You know, my little one calls it the AA hole. You know, she's like, "Everyone, AA hole again." And I'm like, "No." You know, and she's, I always tell one quick little story. My older girl was in treatment, and my little girls were going to visit her one day. And they're like, Mommy, why is Sissy in the hospital? And I thought, God, how do I explain this to him? And I said, well, honey, you know how you have like a little good voice and a little bad voice? And I had these little masks that I usually show at Valley Hope when I talk up there. And I said, you know, the little good voice, little bad voice mask. And I said, sometimes you have the little bad voice that says, hit your sister, and then the little good voice says, you better not. You know, and they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, sometimes the bad voice, you know, wins out. And they're like, yeah. And I said, well, I said, if we listen to the bad voice and it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually, you know, the little good voice over here is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's saying, you're not exercising me. And I said, Sissy's went in the hospital because she can't hear her good voice at all. She's deaf to her good voice. And so she went into the hospital to try to learn how to hear her good voice again. And I said, you know, that's how I left it. And we get to the treatment center, and she's on the door like, Sissy, can you hear your good voice yet? And she's like, oh, thanks a lot, Mom. We're in Valley Hope. She's like, when you were in Valley Hope, it was your back. Now I'm in treatment. It's my good voice, my bad voice. And I'm like, that's because I wanted to tell the truth with you all the time. So back then. It's just been a twist. But the cab driver on the last day that we were there, every time every policeman I've run into, I'm like, what do you think of all these people down there? Like, yeah, you spoiled us down here. You have spoiled us this weekend. And the cab driver, the last night we were on our way back to the hotel, and I'm like, well, you guys gonna miss us, you know, when we leave, Mom? They're like, and the cab driver was very distinct in his words, and he said, you all have changed my life this weekend. And I was like, really? And he said, you all have brought with you a spirit of love that I've never experienced in my life. And he said, and it's something has been missing all my life in here. And you all have what I want. I was just like, whoa. And he said, someone left a book in my car 2 days ago. And there's no way of knowing, you know, who it is and how I can get it back to him. He said, but I'm going home and I'm going to do those steps that you all keep talking about that are in that book. And he wasn't even an alcoholic. And I said, just replace the word alcohol with whatever it is. And he said, I just want what you have. And I said, doing those 12 steps, you will have a spiritual awakening. And then he prayed with us. And I got out of the car. Glory to God. This program is amazing. Absolutely amazing. And I love each and every one of you in there. And when I was out of town and all these alcoholics around, we all had those green tags on. You could just walk up to anyone. And they were your brother, they were your sister, and you loved them, and they loved you back, and you felt it, and it was a miracle. It was an absolute miracle. We just invaded that town. And I think pretty much everyone that was working probably felt it and had a spiritual awakening by the time we left. I don't know. But anyway, thank you.